For me, fashion is a verb. So it's to fashion.
You're listening to Wardrobe Crisis with Claire Press. Join me every week as we look at sustainability, ethics, and the business and madness of fashion. This week, we're back talking about waste colonialism, but with a lens on Uganda. I say we're back again, because we first talked about this with a really great episode with Liz Ricketts from the Orr Foundation about dead white man's clothes in Ghana. Since then, this phrase waste colonialism, I think it's really taken off, not least thanks to the efforts of Liz and Chloe Assam and Samia Tang at the Orr Foundation. But also the news stories are just full of these textile mountains growing in countries that we in Australia and the global north export our donations to. Makes you feel guilty, hey? It's just, it's hectic. I'm sure you've all seen those horrible images of clothing waste in Chile's Atacama Desert. I shared them heaps last year. But I just found out that it's even worse than it looks in the pictures. It's basically that you can see the clothes from space. There's so much of it. Except if you looked now, you'd see nothing. Oh my God, have you read about this? It's been burnt. Yeah. We'll share some links to that crazy story. So I feel like it's definitely about time that I publish this long overdue conversation with Ugandan upcycler and founder of the Baziga Hill label, Bobby Kolade. It was actually recorded quite a while back. I'd been saving it up when my book came out. Bobby is in Where Next? But yeah, it's about time. Now, he is very clear on the problems with the global secondhand trade. Listen to this. Much like Cantamanto in Ghana, Owino Market in Kampala receives huge numbers of bales of secondhand clothing every week. As a result, something like 80% of all domestic clothing sales in Uganda are secondhand. So surely it's a good thing, right, if the country finally says, no more, we don't want your cast-offs. Or is it? In August 2023, Uganda's president announced a surprise national ban on secondhand clothing imports. This just so happened, by the way, to coincide with some major Chinese investment in a textile factory complex in the country. So it's very political, this. It's also not without precedent. You may remember when the EAC, East Africa Community Bloc nations, tried this in 2019, and there was massive pushback from the US, who basically threatened these countries. It's Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, and Burundi with expulsion from the AGOA agreement, which is about preferential trade terms to made in Africa stuff, yeah? And they all caved in except Rwanda, which summarily got punished when the Trump administration banned them from AGOA. Fast forward, and here's Uganda with it back on the table. At first, I wondered if Bobby might be cheering about this, although he'd have to shift his business model for Baziga Hill. But in September, he wrote an op-ed for The Guardian in which he said, I don't believe a ban is the answer. And he argued that with a supply chain as complex and entrenched as this, you can't just dismantle it without really serious consequences for those who earn a living from it, especially further down the chain. And he wrote, according to the Uganda Dealers in Used Clothing and Shoes Association, there are 4 million Ugandans directly and indirectly active in the used clothing and textiles supply chain. And then he talks about how all these orders in the run-up to the holiday season had already been shipped or on the way. And there was no plan for this. So it's like, will they be sent back? Will the 50,000 vendors in Owino Market be compensated or just sent home? What happens to all the small businesses upcycling secondhand clothes and value-adding? And what you'll hear in this podcast is about that value-adding and all the creative skill that goes into it. He also writes in The Guardian, a ban can only work if the affected communities are consulted and alternatives and timelines are collectively designed. He says communities know what they need, so listen and co-create with them. And you'll hear him talk about this at the end of our chat. And I'll just read this out as well from The Guardian op-ed, and we'll share a link so you can read the whole thing, but I thought it was very strong. He says, talks about supporting the Orr Foundation's Stop Waste Colonialism campaign for a justice-led transition from a linear to a circular economy, which holds the global north accountable for its fast fashion waste through an EPR, Extended Producer Responsibility Fund. And he says, for too long, Ugandans have looked outward for role models. We've been coerced into an inferiority complex, yet the solutions are already within. They are at the Owino Market, they're at Baziga Hill, they're in the soil and the rains. They must be supported and nurtured, not threatened by our government and imported ideas. Okay, so where does it leave Baziga Hill? I haven't asked him, actually. And remember, this is recorded before all of this happened. But Bobby did tell Atmos magazine that they haven't changed their business model yet, although they'd never, and he tells me this as well, been absolutely wedded to the fact that they have to use secondhand. There's lots of other things that they can do. They're really into supporting local textile traditions and weavers and new business models. But he does say that all the bales are still, or were, last year, turning up in the market. The traders haven't got any idea if and how the ban will be enforced. And it's all very well to say that these laws are coming, but the practicalities of them are, let's just say, evolving. Now, do listen to episode 150 with Liz Ricketts if you haven't already, or revisit it if you have. And actually, for more context, I highly recommend you follow the excellent podcast, Vintage or Violence, which is co-hosted by Bobby and filmmaker Nikisi Saramuga. As usual, check the show notes for all the links. Okay, let's sit down with Bobby Kolade, the Ugandan designer behind Baziga Hill and the brilliant, provocative Return to Sender. We're recording.
We're recording.
Welcome to the Wardrobe Crisis Podcast, Bobby Kolade.
Thank you, Claire.
Let's start with where we are. We've actually entered the, I want to say bowels, but it seems a little bit more glamorous than that. We're backstage at the Opera House in Copenhagen.
The Royal Opera House.
Fancy.
Yeah, splendid view.
Tell us about what you spoke about yesterday on stage at the conference. We're at the Global Fashion Summit. It's a lot of important big winks discussing the future of sustainability. Also, some provocative voices, which is great. You were one of them. You were on a panel yesterday. What was it called?
Oh my goodness, the name. Subverting Fashion's Exclusivity Problem. Mm. Or was it Inclusivity Problem? Mm-hmm. I can't really remember.
What did you tell us?
I said a lot. I tend to forget what I, what I said. But generally, my message for everybody here was the secondhand clothing trade, which is a huge problem for designers like myself and generally the markets in sub-Saharan Africa. My message to everybody here in the Global North was that we need to consume less, we need to produce less, and we need to find new ways of disposing of our clothes, because Africa can't continue acting as a dumping ground for secondhand clothes.
You also said, and this thing stuck in my mind, we don't want your yellowing, pit-stained T-shirts, or words to that effect.
Yeah, so I was referring to a bale of white shirts that we had sourced in Kampala, where I work.
Uganda,
yeah. And it was button-down shirts from the USA and Canada, because they're often mixed. And the majority of the shirts had yellow stains in the armpits, so I couldn't really use them.
So just for listeners who are like, what? You purchased this bale knowing that you'd asked for white shirts, right?
Yes. So you have to imagine this bale is a 45 kilo compressed package of garments. And there's a label on the bale, and the label shows the identity in terms of where these clothes from, the origin, and what is inside the bale. So it was literally USA, Canada, white men's shirts. Mm-hmm. Literally also white men's shirts, I assume, but...
Yeah, white men's shirts that are also white.
Yes, exactly.
Textiles.
Yes.
But all right, so why do you buy bales of secondhand clothing? Just tell us a little bit about your practice as a designer and an upcycler.
Yeah, so with our brand Baziga Hill, we redesign and repurpose secondhand clothes sourced from the Global North. And we put them on our online shop, and we're trying to sell them back to the Global North, to where they came from. So the project is called Return to Sender, and that's what we're literally doing. We're returning the clothes back to where they came from.
It's provocative, as you are. You want to make a statement as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is our reaction to the problem that we're facing on the ground.
Just sticking on that name of the project.
Yeah.
You presumably really wanted to return unupcycled directly as you got them, these filthy, grotty, sweaty shirts to the sender and say, this is rubbish. This is not what I signed up for.
Yeah, but...
Is it normal?
But the thing is, we are also trying to... We are also trying to sell a positive story here and to show what we can do in Uganda. I wanted to set up a design studio. I wanted to work with tailors and other artists in the country. So by upcycling and repurposing these garments, you know, it is a political statement, but we're also designing. We're also creating, we're adding value to.
So it's a fashion.
Yes. Essentially, yes. We're adding value to this waste product.
Before we press record, I asked you about your background. You said that you'd interned at Margiela?
Yes, Margiela Balenciaga. I lived in Paris for 2 years, but I also had my own brand in Berlin. So I was in Europe for 13 years.
So are you from Sudan, but grew up in Uganda?
No, it's a bit complicated. I was born in Sudan to German Nigerian parents, but I grew up in Uganda, so I call myself a Ugandan.
But the German, so did you have family in Germany? Did you think of living in Germany?
No,
I
didn't.
Or was that just a fashion thing after Paris or?
No, I actually moved to Germany from Uganda because I had a German passport. I moved there for the free education.
Did you study fashion?
I studied fashion in Berlin, 6 long years.
6 years?
Yeah.
You'd be a doctor at that time.
Back then, the system was still like the diploma system. So we didn't really have BA and MA.
When you look back at your student self then, I mean, pretty high. It doesn't get higher fashion than Margiela. What were your dreams, or Balenciaga and Margiela? What were your dreams label-wise then?
Balenciaga, Margiela.
You want to work for a big house?
Yeah. I was all about Paris. I was all about luxury fashion. I loved Nicolas Ghesquiere back then and Madame Margiela. So those were the two brands I really wanted to work for. And I was really happy that I got that opportunity. But it also, you know, especially towards the end, it opened my eyes and I realized I wasn't really happy. Or I saw many people who weren't really happy doing what they were doing as assistant designers in Paris.
Like a burnout thing or like a...
Lack of self-fulfillment and you're just working for a system. And it was one of my cleverest moments in my life, realizing that I don't want to stay in Paris.
Because some might listen to this, especially because we have lots of fashion student listeners and think, oh, you were there. You were right there. You wanted to work in Paris. You had this access to these big houses. You could have continued on that path. Why did you stop?
Maybe I was just disillusioned. It's not amazing. Like, you know, you're an intern and then you become an assistant designer and then you might become a head designer one day. And you're just working towards this singular vision of a creative director for a company that's not really mindful of the planet.
Oh, well, that's what I was wondering. I was wondering if there was a moment. Sometimes there's an inciting incident that gets people thinking about, in your case, we're thinking about waste. I know there's more to it. But the environment or fashion as an industry's impacts on social injustice. What was it for you?
I really think it was more emotional. I had close friends who had never completed their university degrees in fashion and got trapped in internships and then became assistants. And we're just like stuck in the system of having a job at a very, you know, popular and beloved house. And I hadn't finished my education. I hadn't finished my diploma. There was once this story at Balenciaga that the fabrics used to create one collection could be rolled all around the outskirts of the entire city. Because, you know, Nicolas Ghesquiere was crazy. I once worked on this dress and, you know, we made 23 prototypes in order for him to see like one fold. And as I said, this is intense. The luxury industry really a lot of the time gets away with, you know, all of their, let's say, problems in production and supply chains because they call it luxury and because it's, you know, priced at a very insane level. And yeah, but they're also overproducing. Between 2016-17, I closed my brand in Berlin and I had some time off to just really look into myself and ask myself what I want to do, because I'd felt very disillusioned by luxury fashion and Berlin and Paris, and actually, to some extent, almost a bit broken because, you know, two things hadn't worked out for me. It's very difficult to close your own brand after all the money and the love and the time and the back pain you put into it.
Did you close it because you couldn't make money?
For several reasons. We ran out of money and we weren't making money fast enough to sustain the business. We just made, poor decisions. I was young, didn't really have a lot of business acumen, and I should have done some more research and worked more, actually, instead of starting a brand so early.
Mm.
Yeah. So I had a lot of time and a lot of time to reflect. And, you know, when you reflect and when you do therapy, you always end up thinking about home and where you came from. And that's what happened. Literally, I started looking back at Uganda and thinking, you know, if my future is in fashion, then I think it should be with Uganda. So that's what I did.
I think you said to me when we were discussing the impromptu questions, I should say, it's like the least prepared I've ever been to an interview, because I saw you speak on stage yesterday and then we've been running around and I was like, I just want to talk to you about what you shared. But I confess to knowing very, very little about cotton in Uganda. I just did a quick kind of Google search, but I want you to enlighten us and tell us about this. You also admitted to me that you didn't know much about it yourself either.
No.
Until I grew you started up, this. Yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in Uganda and, you know, rarely did we hear anything about Ugandan cotton. It has been an industry in decline since 1972. So just, you know, for your reference, Uganda once was one of the biggest producers of cotton in sub-Saharan Africa. And the cotton industry was introduced by the British colonialists of the British Protectorate. Exactly. So there is a colonial history and a violent history with Ugandan cotton. But it was a huge employer. The industry was booming in the 60s and the 70s. We did have textile mills and spinning mills. We did produce clothing in Uganda.
So the whole thing.
Absolutely. Growing. It was vertically integrated. It was perfect. And then, of course, you know, early 1970s, Idi Amin kicked out the Asian Ugandan community, and they had the managerial positions, and they were the skilled workforce and running all the factories. So once they left, there was a huge vacuum. Some of these factories were redistributed to Ugandans who obviously didn't have prior experience because the Asian community never let the Ugandans reach those positions.
We'll share some links and you can read around the subject. But just in case you don't want to put down the podcast right now and you're like, but who's Idi Amin? Could you just tell us?
So Idi Amin is probably our country's, unfortunately, biggest export. Everywhere I go, like if I'm traveling the global north. So Uganda, wasn't there this film about, you know, the last king of Scotland, Idi Amin?
Oh, because they've seen the film.
Because they've seen the film.
I just said, because I thought, like, everyone knows because it's such a thing. You think people know from the film?
Yeah, absolutely. People know from the film. And obviously, it was a very controversial story and a very controversial time. And that's what sticks in people's minds. So,
A brutal dictatorship.
Yes, exactly.
In the context of this, there's this direct correlation between that regime and the breakdown of an industry that may have had, did have uncomfortable colonial roots. But before absolutely. That was an employer of Ugandan people, a thriving industry, and like you said, a vertical operation, making stuff in the country.
That's so important. And when you think about it today, we only have two remaining textile mills in the country. Only one of them operates with 100% Ugandan cotton. There are very few jobs. And, you know, from my perspective, it's an industry in the decline. In the 4 years that I've been back home, I haven't seen positive change in the cotton industry. I haven't seen radical growth. And if at all, it's cotton being exported as a raw product. So just to get the figures, you know, back in the 1970s, we processed 75% of all the cotton that was harvested in the country. And now we export 95% of all Ugandan cotton.
The value is leaving the country.
It's leaving the country.
And then potentially the country's being flooded, you tell me if it's the case in Uganda, with cheap Chinese imports in terms of textiles, which is eroding other textile traditions, whether or not it's the cotton supply chain, right?
Yes, but also and more predominantly secondhand clothes from Europe and the Americas, North America.
Tell more about that.
So So we have this situation, you know, 70s, decline of the industry, no more production in the country. And then, you know, the way the colonialists kind of changed into missionaries. You know, it started as missionaries, turned into colonialism, then morphed into missionaries again.
White saviors.
Yes. And so they came into the country with donations of clothing from the global north. You literally had like collection points where people could actually go to receive, to, you know, import.
Perceived by the donators as goodwill.
Absolutely. And I think we have to be clear, it did start as goodwill. Okay. You know, we're donating things we don't need anymore for the poor Africans, lol. And that has changed over the years. It's now a huge industry. It's big business. So while the nature of industry has changed, the perceptions in the global north haven't changed. So people still think they're donating. But it's also because it's so easy for them to donate. And people need an output for all these clothes that they don't wear anymore.
Just talk a little bit more about how the secondhand clothing industry operates today in Uganda. We've made a podcast, we'll share a link, with Liz Ricketts from the Orr Foundation.
Or you can also listen to our podcast, Vintage or Violence.
Or we'll share a link.
Yeah, share a link.
Bobby's got his own podcast. I said to him, you'd know all about setups. He's like, my producers do that. It's a lot more important than I am. Anyway, you can listen back to these shows and we talk a lot about what's happening in Ghana, in Accra. Perhaps you've also heard us talk about Chile, or I'm thinking of other markets, Kenya's Mitumba markets.
Yeah.
But we haven't heard this story on this podcast. So tell us how it's operating now in Uganda.
So just to paint a picture, the biggest secondhand clothing market, or the center for secondhand clothing in Uganda, is in Kampala, in the capital city. There's a market called Owino Market. And that's where all the vendors are. That's where all the clothes end up. Now, around the market, there are huge warehouses. And in these warehouses, clothing importers stock their bales, which they import by the container.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, if somebody in the UK donates their clothes to a charity organization or whatever, some of it ends up on a ship. It's shipped to the Kenyan coast of Mombasa, loaded onto trucks. Those trucks drive to Kampala and then they're offloaded there. And then they're sold from the importers to individual vendors who then open bales and sell to other vendors. And they sell these pieces at the market. So there are thousands of people involved in this trade. But it's a very vulnerable trade, and it's not very reliable. You don't always know what's going to be inside the bale. As I said, you know, many of the shirts we bought were, you know, they had yellow stains. You know, if there's frictions with at the Kenyan border, or, you know, during the COVID period, we had problems with containers coming in and out of the country. So there was stagnation in the market there. You know, I get really angry with people who say, yes, but, you know, we are creating thousands of jobs. I'm like, first of all, you didn't create these jobs. You know, these are people who literally have come up with these solutions for themselves by selling these clothes. And secondly, these are not very sustainable jobs. You know, they're very, very vulnerable. And people aren't really, you know, people go to university and study like sociology and, you know, civil engineering, and then end up selling clothes at a secondhand clothing market.
And selling clothes that have been discarded by the West.
Exactly.
And
it's like we're managing a waste disposal system. You know, we should be paid for this, right? Or we should at least receive investment to look into recycling opportunities and technology and that kind of thing. But no.
How do you then see the secondhand clothing market as exacerbating the problems that are already or long felt in the cotton industry?
Well, it means we are not able to recover. You know, secondhand clothes are so cheap that a lot of the times it's not just the clothes that the global north exports or sends to us, it's the culture of waste. It's the culture. The culture of excessive consumption. It's just the culture of greed also. Because they're so cheap. Many of my colleagues at work, they have so many clothes and so many shoes. I'm like, where do you get all this shit from? It's so cheap. So many people end up with tons of clothes. And so this culture of disposal is also what we're importing. And that's really painful. So as a designer, there is nothing I can produce in the country that can compete against secondhand clothing.
Because of price.
Because of price and diversity as well. You know, we have everything. You have to imagine at these markets, you can buy bed sheets, you can buy underwear, although underwear is forbidden. You can buy belts, leather products, ski jackets, leather jackets, suits, gowns, wedding dresses, curtains, pillows, everything. So we're not just talking about clothes, we're talking about a complete textile industry. You know, if we can't even produce our own bed sheets, although we have the cotton growing in our backyards, there's a huge problem.
Tell us about how your brand, Baziga Hill, offers some sort of solution and a provocation at the same time.
Yeah, so we buy some of these bales and we cut them open and redesign the clothes. So a lot of cutting up, patchworking, changing, you know, shape, form, adding things together, printing, embroidery, the whole works. We're just basically adding value to this waste material.
I know that people can't see it. We'll take a picture. Tell us about the t-shirt you're wearing now.
Oh, I'm wearing one of our four panel patchwork t-shirts. And these are this is a white one with two different prints. So we take panels from four different shirts and sew them back together with the seams on the outside. So
it's cool. It's mismatched. It's misaligned purposefully so yes. that the hems are jagged.
Yes, exactly. We're not making a secret out of the fact
you make a feature.
Yeah.
Some purpose.
Exactly. Mm. So this is what we're doing. And we run an online business from Kampala. And we are selling to everyone who will buy.
You said on stage yesterday that you were facing twin injustices. These are not your words, but
it's a much fancier way of putting it. I like it. I'm going to use it. Twin injustices.
Of not only having to deal with garbage that was sent by former colonial idiots who basically export their waste problem to other countries and don't care that they have no solution. But not only that, but on the way back, return to sender, you're faced or slammed with taxes, import Absolutely. Taxes on this stuff that you've basically upcycled is the nice word for it, but saved from being garbage for us. And then you have to pay twice to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's completely fucked up. This is a huge trade injustice. I think, especially, are many of your listeners in the UK?
Yeah. I mean, they're all around the world.
Okay.
Lots in the UK, lots in other countries in Europe, certainly in the US as well.
Okay. So I'll just give you the example of the UK because they're obviously our colonizer. You know, when we send products back to the UK, we're paying VAT and we're paying import tariffs. And we also pay our service provider to handle all of that process. So by the time we send anything to the UK, we've lost about 46% of our revenue because of all of these taxes and these issues.
But they would say to you, if they read this on paper and weren't in this room listening to the context, that's just international trade terms. Everybody levies taxes when they import new goods, although in this case I know that they are value-added goods, but even so.
And this is the crucial point. The UK, the EU, America, and many trade blocs in the world have a trade deal with Uganda because we're a less economically developed country. So
Because of...
Why are we a less economically developed country? That's another podcast.
I mean, they don't bring that into the trade agreement, no. But that is something we should raise.
Absolutely. So under this trade deal, if you can prove that your product has its origins in Uganda, then you enjoy preferential status. So you receive a preferential certificate of origin. And if you attach this certificate to each parcel you send out of the country, you don't have to pay taxes, or you don't have to pay import taxes in the UK, for example.
What would an example be?
You mean in terms of what?
Product.
Like, so a t-shirt made using Ugandan cotton, coffee.
I was going to say coffee. Yes, just as tea. A thing for people to think
exactly.
about, right?
Tea. So anything that
Ugandan
has been produced...
grown in Uganda.
Exactly. Anything that has been produced in the country using the country's raw materials, basically, enjoys preferential status. However, I hired a lawyer to do this, to do the research, because in these laws, there are explicit paragraphs which say, under the textile department, they explicitly say that if the fabrics are used then they do not enjoy preferential status. So the markets, and the white markets in the global north, are protecting themselves.
Do you think this is on purpose?
Of course it's on purpose. They protect themselves.
But, I mean, with the specificity of the used clothing industry.
Because they want to protect their markets. And they don't believe that they deserve, you know, they don't want used clothes to be sent to them. Europe isn't receiving bales of secondhand clothes from America. No, they're all protected. So I'm like, who was sitting at these tables when the laws were written? And yeah, who was at the table? Did we have a say in all of this?
I don't think you were.
I wasn't there. I wasn't there. I would have made a lot of noise. So I think this is, it is discrimination.
But what you're talking about is, sorry, go on.
No, this is clearly discrimination, right? So
I was going to say it was like protectionism designed on purpose to stop what you have to deal with in Uganda happening to, we couldn't possibly deal with your old crap in our country. Yeah. Can't deal with our own crap.
Yeah, and at the same time.
Do you actually see it that way? Yeah.
And at the same time, these are countries that send, you know, NGOs, aid workers, and lots of aid to our countries to boost our economy and help us implement the sustainable development goals. And here we are, a small company. We've actually found a way of generating interest for an upcycled product using your waste from the global north, and we're being punished for it.
The reason why I'm sort of pushing you on this is because I think it would...
Because it makes me angry?
Yeah, it makes me angry, which is good listening. It makes for good listening. No, because... I'm really interested in the idea that this is by design in order to protect, I'm saying as a person who is from Britain originally, secondhand clothing export business.
Yeah.
Because if that's the case, that is very annoying.
It is the case. And I'm glad you used the word business, because this is big business. And, you know, I'll give you an example of, I think it was 2016, we tried to collectively ban the importation of secondhand clothes from the global north. Rwanda managed to implement this law. The other countries backed down because of the USA. This was during the Trump administration, I believe. And basically, the USA threatened to revoke the AGOA agreement if we banned the importation of secondhand clothes.
Because it's worth so much money.
It's worth a lot of money. It's American companies, it's European companies that are making the big money here. You know, so, but the irony of this also, the AGOA agreement is basically the African Growth and Opportunities Act. And under this act, products produced in Africa enjoy reduced duty fees when they're sent to America. The issue here is, which companies enjoy this preferential treatment? Is it American companies in Africa that are exporting back to America? Or is it actually small-scale companies, SMEs in Uganda, run by Ugandans? Who is actually benefiting here? And then the irony of all of this is, after all my, you know, after I criticize America and after reading about all of these treaties and all of these inequalities, I learned through my business that actually for a company like ours, America is a very favorable market because, you know, we don't have to pay import duties or VAT for any products under $800. So it turns out America is a friend.
Yeah. Well, America, by accident.
By accident.
I talked about, was this done by design? But I think if you're listening to this, we will share some links in the show notes so that you can read around the politics of this story of these East African countries coming together to try to say, we don't want your rubbish anymore. Yeah. And then the Trump administration and a conglomerate of American exporters and secondhand clothing dealers,
lobbyists,
got together and were like, I'm not having it. And so this is very political.
Listen, I studied fashion design. I didn't realize I was going to become embroiled in international trade inequalities and waste management of the global north. It's a lot. I only spend like 10% of my time actually designing.
Are you angry?
Yeah, I'm furious. And I'm most furious when we unpack bales and we find things that are not useful or It also, when I was talking about the vulnerability of the market, there's just so many fluctuations. I'll give you an example. For our first drop, we had these hoodies, which are like, you know, super oversized and patchwork. And we developed like a design process and a system of how we're going to make them. They were, you know, they almost sold out. They're our most successful piece. So I thought, let me react quickly. Let's produce more. So I go to the same importer where we sourced this bale from. And I was like, okay, can I have one of those bales again? You know, the ones with the oversized hoodies. Like, yeah, here they are. So we take this bale home, open it, and half of it is children's hoodies. I was like, but where's the oversized? Where's the large men's, you know, hoodies here? It's just not reliable. And people take advantage of the fact that you can't see what's inside the bale.
Who are you furious with?
Oh, everybody. I think at this stage, it's our politicians. And not only in the Global North, but also in Uganda. Because obviously, you know, we're generating income by allowing these clothes to come into the country. They're heavily taxed. So the government is making money on a local level. But just the audacity of the European Union and the UK and, you know, Canada and America, those are my main, that's where my main problem is, because this is very historic. This has, you know, colonialist tones to it.
Liz uses the term waste colonialism.
Love that term, as painful as it is. This is waste colonialism. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think you said something on stage, again, I'm paraphrasing, I don't know your exact words, but you were like, find your own waste solutions.
Yeah.
Deal with it in your own country.
Deal with it in your own country, yeah. Like, I know this industry is not going anywhere. It's here to stay until consumption patterns in the Global North change. But, you know, if you are going to dispose of an item of clothing you don't want anymore, if it's got holes, if it's got stains, then just throw it in your garbage can. You have better systems of dealing with waste disposal in the UK than we do in Uganda. If you're going to donate, then donate the items that can be reused. Mm. Imagine somebody saving up money to buy a bale and open it and find a portion of it is not useful. You know? And also, you know, you asked, who am I angry with? All these policymakers who are making it so difficult for a small company like ours to sell back to the UK and to interact.
Well, it makes a mockery of the idea of global trade, globalization, and this.
It's not global.
No.
It's a dictatorship. It's a, you know.
Dictatorship's a strong word.
Yeah, it's a trade dictatorship because they're dictating the terms. And they're not letting us in. And fine, if there are problems with our governments and our economy and whatever, fine. But all of the aid work that comes into the country, all of the money and it just feels a bit rotten, you know? There is a new generation of young Ugandans who have innovative products and who are working within the Sustainable Development Goals. So if we don't have access to the markets, how is this supposed to work?
Well, I asked you before, and this is obviously another problem, cost-wise. But yeah. I said, have you a market within Kampala? I was telling you yesterday that I interviewed this fantastic guy, Joram Muzira-Joy, who is a model agent and a larger-than-life brilliant character. So Kampala has a fantastic fashion week. It's got fantastic designers. It's got a vibrant fashion scene of its own. So I said, do you sell your stuff in Uganda? There's a problem though, right? Cost.
Yes, cost, obviously. You know, our price point isn't very accessible for most Ugandans. So even though, you know, when we sell to Ugandans, it's at 50% of our retail.
So you have different prices.
Yeah, for Ugandans, it's 50% off if they express interest through the online shop. Yeah. And, you know, many people within our community, obviously. What was the question again?
Well, I'm just interested in how, I guess it's a question about power imbalances and systemic injustice that delivers inequity of income, shall we say. So you want to create these beautiful things, you're doing it, you're employing, what, 6 people?
For now, yeah.
You're making a brand, but your price point is prohibitively expensive to sell domestically. Presumably you'd like to be selling domestically.
Well,
or that's, not, maybe that, you wouldn't. No, but is the question around, are we keeping industry from thriving by flooding the market with all this rubbish from the West?
Yeah.
And, you know, coming back to the cotton thing, not making space or crowding the space for local industry to flourish, crowding it out by just our garbage.
Yeah, that's the case here. I think, you know, from an investor perspective, if you were to analyze the situation in the country, the buying power is very low. There is some, but it's very low. Of course, there's raw materials everywhere. There's so much secondhand clothing coming into the country. Why should I invest in a facility? Why should I invest in the cotton industry unless I'm just going to be exporting it? So even if we did build up industry, we need foreign currency. So with us, you know, we're making a statement, a provocative statement. It's, you know, Buziga Hill returned to sender. We need foreign currency to build industry.
Let's end on how you would like to see the Ugandan fashion scene and industry change. You're doing a lovely thing where you're pairing five Ugandan hand weavers with five designers. It's through your clothing research program. What's it called?
Aiduke.
Tell us about that.
So Aiduke Clothing Research is a nonprofit that we run on the side. Basically, it's running parallel to Buziga Hill. So basically, all the knowledge and information and the experience that we're collecting through our operations with Buziga Hill, we are trying to share with other designers.
So, it's so good.
Yeah, we're really in the initial phase. And because we're also a research company, we're looking into hand weaving. So there are a few hand weaving studios or workshops in the country, but no one is really working with designers, or designers aren't really working with them. They haven't really been exposed to them. So what we're trying to do is to put these two worlds together and see what happens. And this is the pilot project for this.
Did you do a call out for designers?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we did a call out for designers. And, you know, really interesting, there wasn't like a massive response because it's obviously something very new. And people are just wary of like Ugandan made, you know. Mm. And also, we've just been spoiled by the availability of fabrics from Turkey, China, you name it. People want like shiny stuff, stretchy fabrics. It's this whole other culture has been imported into the country. So it's also really difficult to say what is Ugandan anymore, you know, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, in terms of design and fabrics, we're just an interrupted state. We've never actually been allowed to flourish because the British came in with the cotton and the Arabs as well. So what is actually Ugandan like? And we were never given a chance to develop our cotton industry because of obviously political insecurities and secondhand clothing. So it's actually quite depressing.
We can't end on that, mate.
No, we can't end on that. So listen, so what I want to see, you asked me what I want to see. I want to see a factory. I want to see technology. I want to see exchange programs between universities in the UK and universities in Uganda. I want to see us looking into new ways of upcycling these clothes. They are there. So if you are going to send your clothes to us, can we at least add value to a supply chain? Can we not just be the end station, the dumping ground? I want a factory of 1,000 people in Kampala, and then maybe move on to other places in the country. I really want to see an industry grow. You know, that's my dream.
Thank you for listening to Wardrobe Crisis. You can find the show notes for each episode and read our magazine over on our website, www.thewardrobecrisis.com. And that's where you can also sign up for our free sustainable fashion newsletters. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I'd love you to help us spread the word. Tell a friend, share on social media, or leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps new listeners find us on the app. You can get in touch with us on social media. The show is on Instagram at The Wardrobe Crisis, and I'm on there too, and on Twitter. I'm at Mrs. Press. Because I love you, because I love you, because I love you, because I love you.